This is a UOA on campus production. This podcast was recorded on Kaurna land. We acknowledge the Kaurna people as the original custodians of the land and pay our respects to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples.
You'll want to make a note.
Should you be taking notes or something?
You got a pencil? Write this down, quick.
Why aren't you taking notes?
Write this down.
Aren't you going to write this down?
Did you need me to take notes?
Please take note.
Hello and welcome to Take Note, the podcast where we give you the best notes on everything you need to know from the day you start uni to the day you graduate. I'm your host and current honours student, Shannon, and today we'll be talking about healthy relationships. We'll be chatting with student counsellors Jackie and Joe about how to have a healthy relationship and the ins and outs of consent. Just a note before we get into today's episode, we do touch on themes of unhealthy relationship behaviours, sexual assault and domestic violence. If you're in a place right now where this content isn't for you, please feel free to skip this episode for now, but do come back when you're ready so you can hear what our wonderful experts have to say. The conversations in this episode are general in nature, so please reach out to a healthcare or counselling professional if you're struggling. Something I think we're all striving for is to have good relationships, particularly in our romantic lives. We give so much of ourselves and so much trust into our partners that it's really important that those relationships are healthy. So we're joined today by student counsellor Jackie to get into the nitty-gritty of what a healthy relationship is comprised of and how we can get there. Thank you so much for joining me today, Jackie.
Thank you so much for having me, Shannon.
We all heard so many things about relationship red flags and what to look out for, but what are maybe some relationship green flags that can tell us our relationship is in a good place or that we have a caring partner?
Yeah, that's a very, very good question. I think we kind of, in the society, you know, Google has become our best teacher these days about, what the red flags are. And it's kind of a little bit of a shortcut, probably saying, oh, yeah, what the green flags are, because it's easy for us to compare. I'm probably not really talking about so-called green flags. What I'm going to talk about is what we are looking for more in a particularly romantic, intimate relationship. So just to be clear, today, this topic, most of the time I would focus on is romantic, intimate relationship. Yeah. Some of the content we discuss probably can also actually be suitable for other type of relationship or friendship, but that's not my focus today. So, yeah, what are we looking for more, you know, in our intimate relationship? Is, for instance, I can give you an example. The very, very big one of the biggest issues we often can identify is communication in our romantic relationship, which is completely normal, completely understandable. So, for instance, with communication, what do we look for more then? You know, what that healthy sign look like between my partner and myself in that relationship. So one of this, does my partner listen to me? You know, we all have time to share our thoughts, our emotions in that relationship. When I feel emotional or whatever, that excitement or a little bit sad or a little bit down, can I talk to my partner and can I feel being heard? Or they're just like, brush it off. That's big difference then.
Yeah.
And another one is, do they speak respectfully to me? You know, can I be vulnerable in front of them then? I can tell them how I really feel, because sometimes we do have certain, you know, kind of a shame feelings occasionally.
Yeah.
That can happen in all of us. And can I be open about that? Or I feel like, oh, the better not to say that, because otherwise they would say, oh, you're just stupid. Don't be stupid about that.
Yeah.
That's it. So ultimately, I feel safe to be vulnerable in front of my partner. Or does my partner speak me well in front of others? You know, we go out to meet friends, families. Do I feel like I have been respected?
Totally.
By them. Or they're just saying, oh, here she is. Yeah, she's just a bit emotional. Well, that's, or instead of saying, yeah, she's not feeling the best today and please leave her alone, give her a little bit of space. That's very, very different way.
Yeah, the respect.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's always the highest priority. And if we look at, you know, on my card, freedom. So what does that look like? Do I have the freedom to do my own thing in my own time? Or do I have to always do things that they like to do? Mm. Give you an example, you know, personally, I like traveling. And my partner, well, he's okay. Is that his first choice? Probably wouldn't be at times. Have we traveled together? Yes, a lot of times. Have I traveled without him? Yes. So do I have the freedom to say, well, actually, I want to go here with my friends. And he had a choice. Well, I want to go with you or I don't. And we both feel okay about it.
Yeah.
That's very important. And I can understand, you know, from a sort of a social norm that in the past it may look a little bit odd, but actually we're all our individuals.
Mm.
Do we have this choice? Do we have this freedom?
It gives us space for our other relationships as well.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally. Yeah. I can build that relationship with my friends. It doesn't have to be travel, you know. Can I go out regularly with my friends to catch up? Or at times to catch up. The issue we need to look out for is, can I do that if I want to? Does my partner support me?
Yeah, that support is so key.
Yeah, absolutely. Does that make, yeah, I hope that makes sense.
Definitely.
And, you know, another thing, one of the biggest dynamics I have seen in my work, not only at a university, but in my previous work experience as a social worker as well, is about finance. Mm. So we heard so much now these days in the society, through media, everywhere, particularly in domestic family violence dynamic, we heard a lot about financial abuse.
Yeah.
Because they can be really subtle and invisible. Mm. So what do we look out in a healthy relationship? What do we look out more for, you know, from a finance perspective then? And one of the things is, do I have the say to make our shared decision? So for instance, if my partner comes back home and just telling me, just bought a car, signed a loan today. It's like, oh, what's happening here?
Yeah.
So what we need to look out is, okay, do I get a say? Do I, if he wants to buy a car, then it's under his name, but do I have a kind of a, can I contribute some decision-making? Hey, is this the best time? This is how our finance looks like. Maybe have you thought about we might be struggle? I don't think this might be a good time. Then do they listen?
Mm-mm.
Do they respect my say, my opinion? And so that's multiple. That then back to communication, you know.
Yeah.
And they might say, what we want to see is they're like, yeah, you're right. You've got a point. True. You know, maybe we can do this way. Let's look at how we share this car, the current car together, or how we fix the issue we have with the car, whatever that might be. And then maybe let's do some savings.
Yeah, so approaching it as a team.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Not just like, okay, that's my decision, done deal.
Yeah, yeah.
Or with finance, you know, it's like also, do they respect my role? So we've generated a lot of discussions these days in our society to draw people's attention, not to underestimate particularly mother, stay-home mothers' roles.
Yeah.
Or stay-home father as well. You know, there's a little bit of increase these days. A lot of fathers have decided to stay home. So whatever, for whatever reason, they made that decision, which is great. So then how do we look at their financial contribution? Because when they don't have that figure, that number, physical number, they contribute to the family bank account, it doesn't mean they don't contribute. We can underestimate their contribution of staying home, looking after the children, looking after the housework and everything. But we you know, a lot of that's the discussion we had before. A lot of particularly stay-home mothers felt like so undervalued.
Yeah.
And they operate 24/7 pretty much. But then
it's a lot.
It is. But then, you know, with my previous work experience, what we saw a lot was, well, you haven't contributed to this family, so then you deserve some of my sort of verbal abuse and emotional abuse. No. Yeah. No one deserves that. And when it comes to romantic relationship, there's a lot of, like you said, the nitty-gritty parts. And every relationship has its own unique dynamic.
Yeah.
So it's only kind of a sort of a broad view. I hope that can give people a little bit idea what we're looking out for.
I think it's good. I think we hear so much about, I guess, like I said, the negatives to be aware of in a relationship, but it doesn't really help you when you want to be like, but is it a healthy relationship? Is this a good
Correct.
One? You know, learning what it is, and also for your own behaviors as well, the own way for you to treat your partner.
Yes.
I think it's also a really nice reminder of how you can show up as a really good partner in your relationship.
Absolutely.
And make that contribution to the team.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
And I guess going on from that, how does it, I guess, feel? How should it feel to be in a healthy relationship?
Yeah. Again, that's a very good question. Probably being a counsellor for quite a while, I'm so mindful of telling people how they should feel. That's not my job. However, what I would encourage people to really look in, connect with themselves, is do I feel safe? And like back to what we talked before, can I be vulnerable in this relationship? If I can't be vulnerable, I have to be on alert all the time. I have to be on guard. Or most of the time, even not all the time, most of the time, probably maybe that is a question mark. What's happening here? It doesn't necessarily mean it's toxic, it's abusive. We don't want to draw that conclusion very quickly.
Yeah.
But that is the point. Probably we can ask ourselves, what's happening here? Why do I feel like this? Why do I feel I have to be on guard all the time? Again, that can be complex. So for some people, because of their upbringing and growing up experiences, it might be tricky for them. You know, it might also be foreign as well. And saying that, I'm not referring, just please be mindful. I'm quite mindful about what I'm talking, because just my past working experience coming from a complex trauma area, I can kind of think about so many that sort of scenarios.
Yeah.
And I'm not referring to that. I just want to make that clear. But sometimes it might be foreign for us to feel like, to say to ourselves, oh, I feel completely 100% safe. But most of us do. Most of us, doesn't matter where on the spectrum, how safe we feel, we know ourselves. Just
trust yourself.
You are the expert of your own life. No one else is, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So if this relationship doesn't go kind of 100% well or safe or healthy, then individuals, they will feel it and then question that.
And I guess going on from that, you, like you're saying, just because something isn't 100% doesn't mean that the relationship is toxic or
absolutely
or bad or
correct.
Anything like that. So what are, I guess, some of the common issues that relationships can face that aren't necessarily toxic or dangerous or things
like
that?
Yeah, yeah. That is particularly what we see a lot, is particularly at the beginning of any intimate relationship, you know, when you still kind of form this teamwork relationship together.
You're adjusting.
Yeah, absolutely, getting to know each other. But also for university students, if we look at the population, age of the population, a lot of young people. So we are still in the process of exploring ourselves as well, you know, who I am as a young adult. Then bringing in another individual, communication is the biggest kind of it's a key, but also it can fall off very, very easily,
yeah.
If that makes sense. Yeah. So sometimes, you know, it's just like talking like this. There's no negative intention or both good intentions, but just it's like, why don't you understand? Yeah, because you come from different perspectives.
Yeah, I feel like you're almost, you know, particularly in the early stages of a relationship, you're learning how to love someone else, or that person in particular as well.
Yeah, yeah. But also we are learning about how to accept ourselves, how to give ourselves that permission, acceptance. A lot of it's happening actually in this particularly age bracket, you know, the university setting, like what I'm referring to probably is not more mature age student, is more like a young, fresh kind of young adults. But also you're still learning the communication and the negotiation with the society as well as an adult. And then in the meantime, coming into this relationship. So that's another learning and adjusting and, yeah, a lot.
It's a lot going on.
Yeah.
And I guess if someone is having issues in their relationships, you know, the communication just isn't quite, you're talking at cross purposes, it's not coming together,
yeah,
or things like that. What, I guess, is your advice for how someone maybe should manage that, or how, where they could potentially get some advice on how to come together with that talking a bit more?
Yeah, absolutely. There are very many different ways to do that. I think the most important thing is to be aware. So both parties, are we aware, hey, something is not quite right. We are not really talking to each other, kind of connecting well. Okay, what's going on in my communication? What's going on there? And really can we have a clear communication then? So be very, very clear. And this also involves some boundaries then. So, you know, one of the biggest issues we have seen, and even personally, you know, as a young adult back then, I experienced was, does he like me? Because he did not talk back. You know, little things like that. And we can internalize very easily. But then instead of that, can we ask ourselves, oh, does my partner actually, is that okay for them to have some emotions as well? It's absolutely okay.
Yeah.
And sometimes even it's even not like that. You know, like, again, referring myself, my partner is a very quiet person, for instance. And sometimes he just doesn't say much. That's just how who he is.
Yeah.
And I could say a lot, and then doesn't mean he does not respond to me. He does. But then also means, you know, he may not talk as much as I do. Is that okay? Absolutely. Was it okay, you know, when we just started dating? It was a little bit of problematic.
Do some figuring out there.
Yeah. And sometimes, for instance, we see a lot is one party probably feels, for instance, exams coming up, and we have all our own ways to deal with our stress, to manage that. And one party might feel completely, like, really stressed out, really anxious. Then they kind of shut down a little bit and they really regroup themselves, try to focus on that. Not, like, completely being able, you know, to communicate that well, sitting down with their partner, hey, just a heads up. I'm going to be highly anxious.
Yeah.
I'm going to be quiet for the next 2 weeks. It may not, highly likely doesn't happen like that.
Yeah.
But for the other party, it might be very confusing. And so they might be like, what's going on here? You know, I thought this relationship has been going well, and suddenly they're quiet.
Mm.
And they don't really communicate or connect as much as we used to in the last few months. And then this point in time is important. You can raise this to the partner. Hey, this is what I've noticed. And then, but in the meantime, we have to tell ourselves, is it okay for my partner to have some emotions? Yes, it's absolutely okay. But this, then the other party I would encourage people to do is, yes, when we are in some kind of a distress situation or moment, some of us tend to say less. You don't have to respond straight away, but make it clear and tell your partner, there's nothing wrong about this relationship, you know. However, can I take a little bit of time to think about how to answer this? And so each party knows, okay, right, I've got a little bit of reassurance, but in the meantime, I will get an answer. It seems like they might are experiencing some big emotions, and that's okay. And this party is like, okay, I am quite stressed at the moment, but I know I've got time to answer this, and I want my partner actually to know this is about just I'm experiencing personally. Does that make sense? So
yeah.
Really clear communication.
Yeah, so I guess the person that's sort of having a bit of a struggle time is sort of letting their partner into that a little bit, while the other one allows them to sort of have that space to deal with it in their own way.
Yeah, absolutely. And to make that communication open and quite clear. There's nothing to hide, but also in the meantime, we need our own space as well.
Yeah. Going on from that, I think it's quite common for there to be a dynamic in a relationship where one person is really happy to have lots of space, or, yeah, you know, wants to, yeah, take their time to, whether it's talking about an issue or just seeing their, yeah, partner or something like that, whereas the other one is very much... doesn't that space maybe makes them feel anxious, or they, yes, just, you know, have that feeling where they just want to be with their partner,
yeah,
a lot, or, you know, maybe, yeah, if they're having an issue or a discussion and one partner says, I just need some space, but that sends the other one a bit off the wall.
Oh, totally.
How do you sort of meet in the middle with things like that when it comes to figuring out those, I guess,
yeah,
little tight points within the pain points within a relationship?
That's a very, very good point. To me, from my observation and my work experience, I think, again, back to that clear communication. We are not, to be honest, especially when we are young adults, it we are still learning about how to communicate clearly. So really be focused on, I would encourage to focus on that. And sometimes communication can be so many different ways, especially these days with technology. I'm not really big a fan about communicating through text or social media. I'm still old school. But saying that, because we've got a lot of also researchers show how that eye contacts can really bring in that relational connection.
Or even just better hold hands when you're talking about something intense.
Absolutely. Just sitting next to each other. So sometimes, you know, it's about, oh, can we find negotiation then? Where is the middle point? If we both parties can remain that open channel, clear communication, then that will give them a bridge to come eventually to come to some negotiation. So a healthy relationship relies on a lot of negotiations as well, because again, we're just two different individuals, you know. If it can't really, it still doesn't work, I would really encourage people then to look at, okay, can we find, for instance, get, you know, talk to friends. And often we have mutual friend who sometimes really good mutual friends can bring this together.
Interesting.
Yeah, yeah. And then because they see from a very, you know, from a third perspective.
Yeah.
So sometimes they can see things out of the clouds.
And they don't bring all that emotional
Correct.
Intensity.
Absolutely spot on. Yeah. And or if, you know, people are open to about getting more professional support and book with us, come to the uni counsellors and have a chat about, you know, this is what I experienced. So the counsellors can really unpack with the student about that particular moment, what that looks like, and really process what's going on there. Or people do go, it's okay to go to, like, for instance, a couple relationship counselling, and then they will support, the counsellor can support couples to sit together, to negotiate, to either that's negotiate, they would observe what's happening there in that relationship. There are so many different ways to hopefully clear that channel, and then these two parties can have some clear communication to build that connection.
Yeah, and I think there's so many, I guess, misconceptions that, you know, couples that have to see, you know, good counselling are probably in a bad way or something like that. But I think it's good to know that maybe that is actually a healthy behaviour to go
Absolutely.
And seek that assistance in that communication as you're figuring each other out.
Oh, totally, totally. We do have a lot of stigma, you know, like we had before, for instance, with mental health. We kind of have done a great job to really challenge that stigma, but doesn't mean it still doesn't exist. So, but saying that, I've seen a lot of couples even get couple counselling before they really commit to each other into marriage.
Yeah.
Really to learn, because again, you know, to commit with each into this long-term relationship, marriage doesn't mean happy ending and then afterwards forever.
Yeah.
It involves so much more clear communication and the negotiations. Little things like I probably, you know, I don't mind having a little bit things lying around the house. It doesn't have to be clear and clean, tidy every single day. But my partner may like something very different.
Yeah.
So how do we even negotiate that?
Yeah. Bringing two lives together, it's a bit tricky.
Oh, yeah.
You are talking, I guess, about how therapy and mental health support has been normalised and become a bit more common, which is great. We are seeing so much more, I guess, awareness of ourselves and ways to communicate how we feel. But you do still hear stories of people, I guess, almost weaponising and misusing that same language in a way that might control their partners. Like, I think there was a high-profile example of this pretty recently with Jonah Hill, who's an actor, telling his girlfriend that it was a boundary of his that she doesn't surf with other men or post photos of herself in a bikini or have friendships that he didn't approve of. And you did sort of mention boundaries before. So could you maybe just clarify with us what a boundary actually looks like in a relationship, maybe what it's not?
Oh, that's a tricky question. Yes, these days we talk a lot about boundaries. Boundaries are not black and white. It fluctuates. It's dynamic. Again, draw back our previous conversation, I would encourage people to feel like to really have that check in with themselves. Do I feel safe here? You know, if is it like, okay, do I agree that my partner requests me not to do this, not to do that, gives me all the restrictions, and to call this is a boundary? Okay, if it is, that might be a boundary of theirs. Is this a boundary of mine? So, for instance, often in this kind of a case, the example you raised, highly likely I would be interested to learn how she felt hearing that. Highly likely we would feel like, oh, do I have freedom then?
Yeah.
And then we go back to what we're looking out more, for instance, the freedom. Then we all have also a kind of a previous life to check in, to help us check in. Do my family do this to me? Did my parents give me all these restrictions? Mind you, parents do give us a lot of restrictions because they're parenting.
Yeah.
But doesn't mean they completely take away our freedom, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So if we feel like, oh, I don't feel like I've got the freedom here, or I don't feel like really safe, then highly likely our boundary probably has been violated or breached.
Totally.
To a degree.
Totally.
I'm not sure if I've answered your question.
Yeah, so I guess you're talking about boundaries as something that applies to you and yourself.
Absolutely.
That might be his boundary for him and his own behaviour, but your boundaries are about your behaviour.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I guess it's not okay for them to put their boundaries on you because
absolutely
that steps
not
out of their own behaviour.
Oh, absolutely. Was there a negotiation? Was there a communication? It doesn't sound like. It sounds like that's my demands and that's what you need to do.
Yeah. And I guess would you say that's when something, I guess, steps out of being a boundary and it's no longer that, but it's actually an act of control?
Look, without knowing the whole scenario, I am mindful, you know, how I put down my words, but that definitely gives me a lot of signs of, telling me, oh, there's something going on here and there needs to be a lot of unpacking here.
Yeah.
Because the statement doesn't really stand for respect towards their partner.
Yeah, and their partner's freedom.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Jackie, for sharing all that with us.
That's my pleasure, Shannon.
Hey there, students. My name is Lily. Welcome to Mindful Moment, brought to you by the Student Health and Wellbeing Team. I know I'm in a healthy relationship when it makes me feel safe, warm, and comfortable. I've learnt that it's not just about the other person being respectful and honest, it's also about me having the confidence to voice my needs and boundaries. Some of my green flags in relationships include feeling like I can bring up uncomfortable topics, laughing together and being silly, feeling heard and seen by the other person, and knowing that they're willing to be vulnerable and talk about their feelings. A red flag for me is if I get a gut feeling that something just doesn't feel quite right. There may not be a logical explanation, but I think it's always important to listen to what your instincts say. Thanks for taking this moment with me. Your well-being is important, and until next time, take care and be kind to yourself. be sure to follow us on Instagram and Facebook at U of A Student Wellbeing.
You've heard it talked about before. You've even done learning modules on it as part of your university experience, but let's have a chat about consent. We want to arm you with the tools to recognise what is and isn't consent so you can keep yourself, the people around you and your partners safe. Student Counsellor Jo has joined me to give us a bit of a rundown on what you need to know about consent. So thank you so much, Jo, for joining me today.
Hi, thank you.
So can you run us through what are the prerequisites for consent?
Okay, so I guess first we need to clarify what we're talking about when we mean consent. Sometimes people assume we're talking about sexual activity, but really consent's an important concept that's quite a broad one. There's consent for particular medical procedures. We talk a lot about consent in relation to touch. But talking about sexual consent, some of the main concepts that are really important for our students to know about is that the law in South Australia specifically mentions free and voluntary consent. So that's some of the terminology, because we're talking a lot about these things these days more than ever. And there's a lot of different discourse, which is wonderful, a lot of different conversations about consent and sexual consent in particular. People will hear different words and there is new language being used. And it's really not that everything is new. It's just we're finding more ways to describe it and get clear on it, which is wonderful. But I think we need to know what the law is. And it talks about being free and voluntary agreement to engage in particular activity. And when we say free and voluntary, there's actually a list in our laws in South Australia, it's the Criminal Law Consolidation Act, that says when it can't be free and voluntary. So there's a set of conditions there or situations in which it's not even about yes and no. It's about saying you cannot provide consent if these things are happening.
Yeah.
Which is wonderful. We've always had some really good, clear legislation around this. And a lot of other states are doing some legal reform for good reason. But perhaps we might not have needed to just yet, because we have got that very clear list. Some of the things in there around things like obviously force and fear. Unlawful detention, being asleep and unconscious or intoxicated to the point of being incapable of giving consent. Things like physical, mental, intellectual impairment of capacity, so talking about someone's capacity to give consent, and that might include things like intellectual disability, if that's, you know, quite high level of impairment there, that person might not be able to give consent, for example. It really depends on the situation. It's very much a case-by-case basis. Being unable to understand the nature of that activity. That might be about age.
Yeah.
If somebody thinks this is, they're being told that it's about some other purpose or fun and loving behaviour when actually it's abuse. Mistaken identity, if someone's actually stepping in at a party in the dark, they've tagged their mate and gone in the dark and pretended to be that person. And that's happened. We've had these cases in the media, say football teams. And mistaken about the purpose of activity, that might be someone saying, I'm a doctor and this is a medical procedure or therapeutic purposes that we're doing this, and it's not actually at all, and that person's not what they're saying they are.
Yeah.
So there's a whole, sorry, that was quite a list.
No, I think
but it's
good
wonderful,
to know.
So clear.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, following on from that, what does classify as a no? Because I think for a lot of people it says, you know, well, they didn't say no. So, yeah, where's the line?
Yeah, that's right. And that's the one thing we already had some reform around. In 2008, we already had some reform to say a person doesn't need to fight someone off or say no out loud for it to be classified. We're talking now about specifically about particular activities, so penetrative types of activities, things like rape. So if that person was in a situation where any of those conditions were present that I've just described, that they don't need to say no because they couldn't consent because of any of those reasons. So we already had that there to make that really clear, because sex doesn't always come down to yes and no, and we've moved probably a little bit away from that concept of someone needs to be saying yes or actively saying no. Sometimes people can't say no. They might be too intoxicated. They might be unconscious. So you can see there that we've got to actually think a bit more broadly about the onus being on the person who's engaging and being proactive and seeking consent, that they need to keep checking in and being sure that this person wants to be here now doing this with you.
What about in some of those more nuanced, I guess, scenarios that maybe aren't about the capacity to give consent, but it could just be someone has sort of, I guess, suggested they haven't really said yes, but they haven't completely said no. Might be like, I guess, okay, maybe, like, yeah, where does that kind of line come in?
Yeah, sure. That's really a really good one. And we do have these conversations in the counselling service with people sometimes about this kind of thing, because especially when you're younger or newer to sexual activity, ideas around boundary setting, they can be quite foreign to people or unpracticed, or it might be a person's socialisation that they really want to be a people pleaser, feel like they have to make everything okay, not put themselves in the picture, think about other people's needs. All these sorts of things come into play. So we know that from research, women's ways in particular of saying no can be very indirect, and that is something we just need to understand and accept rather than completely say it needs to change. What has to happen is that person is making sure that they're not misreading, especially when alcohol's involved, or if they might be determined to meet their needs. Whatever's going on, they can actually override or disregard the signals that someone's giving them that is actually about they're not being consent. So if someone's looking away, looking down, closing their eyes. You know, I've had people talk about crying and that's been ignored. They might be checking out, completely disassociated or disappearing, quite shut down. They might be experiencing pain and they've left the room mentally. So there's lots of situations we talk to people about where it's really crucial that people engaging in sexual activity know the onus is on them to be really clear and making sure and reading body language and all of the cues that are there, and the cues are there.
Yep.
We don't hear the stories where there's no, the cues are there, behavioural cues. They're actually as important as verbal for consent.
Yeah, so I guess maybe looking for a bit of enthusiasm might be a way of, I guess, gauging whether someone is.
Yeah, that's one of the terms that's being used a lot now. I think that's being used a lot with the younger cohort to make things really clear, but you know, I think when I've also talked as a sexual therapist with people who are older and perhaps in longer term relationships, and they've said to me, sometimes I don't seem so enthusiastic, Joe, but I've definitely negotiated what's happening with my partner. And it might be that, you know, it's like I'm a little bit sleepy tonight and I've really, really been okay with them having intercourse with the back of my sweaty knee, the crook of my knee in summer when it's hot and sweaty.
Yeah.
Now, that's a terrible example. But the gritty realism of people's lives is, in the end, it's about absolutely having that communication, negotiation, and that being ongoing and checking in. And, you know, let's keep this light. It doesn't all have to be serious, but there can be a bit of humour about that, like that couple were telling me with a bit of humour about how they negotiate that sort of stuff. But it is about mutual agreement and being free and voluntary.
Yeah, and you've sort of mentioned it there. I think a lot of people do find a bit more grey area when it comes to consent when they're maybe in a relationship. So what does consent look like in, say, a long-term relationship where you might have this established routine of getting, you know, engaging into sexual activity?
Yeah, and I think that's where we were heading just then in that conversation, when it can be kind of very nuanced. Firstly, it's really important to say that it doesn't matter how long you've been with someone, how much you believe you can read their mind or you get established into set routines. Always absolutely important that every moment, every day is a new day. And it's a bit like having a friend who's a person that you always give a hug to, and they might be going through something where that changes and you need to just be like, oh, sorry, well, you can pick up that as you approach them, they don't feel up for a hug today. Maybe it's something you've done or maybe it's nothing to do with you. It's the same thing in relationships. Just because we've had sex before doesn't mean that's always going to be the case. We go through our ups and downs. Relationships do, but also we do as humans. So always that consent's important. And as long as it's negotiated and communicated well, that's what we're looking at. But it still has to be ascertained that you're up for it in that moment, and it continues throughout the interaction.
Yeah. And you've used that word negotiation a lot. When does a situation, I guess, move out of consent and negotiation into, say, coercion? And what does that mean or look like?
Yeah. So the word coercion isn't actually a legal term in South Australia, but it's definitely a term that's really useful to use. But coercion in terms of sexual behaviour is when someone's really ignoring and repeatedly disregarding your cues, your signs that you're giving for non-consent. So it might not just be sexual behaviour. We're also talking about someone's come and sat next to you. You might even be in a public place because people can be quite bold in some of this behaviour. And you've felt that they're sitting a bit too close to you or on the bus perhaps, and you might shift a little in your seat and that person shifts over with you and they're almost on top of you. And I hear these stories from students. It's the ways in which they start to gauge your level of fear and compliance and how much they can get away with to go down that road of either maybe indecent assault or further. So they'll be looking to override and ignore and then escalate that behaviour. And what can really typically happen and why it's so powerful is that we know now that it's very well understood and recognised that something called a freeze response, you know, the fight, flight, freeze kind of responses people have when they're under threat or challenge, it's actually called involuntary immobilisation. It's something that we really understand now, that the threat centre of the brain perceives that women know when they're at risk, and they know the statistics generally about women, that it's men's use of violence against women that causes deaths the most. It's often a known person. So it's for very good reason that that person might go into a bit of a freeze response, and then that is exploited by that person. So it's very important we start to recognise this more and more. One of the things I want to say is referring to the legislation is it does specifically say rape, for example, occurs without consent or when consent has been withdrawn or when there's indifference to consent. And that bit there, because people are looking for the word coercion, that's the bit that we focus on when we try and explain to people. It's okay, you didn't have to fight him off. You didn't need to scream. You didn't need to shout no.
Yeah.
So it's a bit like, you know, can I have a bite of your sandwich? I know that these have been analogies that have been overused and they can go astray. But we need to think just how do we generally show respect and reciprocity, the two-way nature of interactions, and care with one another just generally. And what we do is the way we approach that and then the invitation with an openness to that invitation, that's really important. And then that person might actually be, like you were saying before, they might be a bit unsure, and it might be then where do we go from here? Do we want to try it or not? Do we want to do something else? Should we stop? These things don't have to be as hard as we might imagine. I definitely can vouch that counselling couples for a very long time, I've worked for nearly 30 years in the field, a good 20 of that was in sexual health, that it really oils the wheels to get used to, especially with a bit of lightness to it and simplifying things, not making it hard, to be learning to just communicate. And it might not be in the moment. It might be beforehand. Sometimes it's important to talk after about how we'd like things in the future. So, you know, all of that's important around just making our relationships work. We're not taught this stuff. We're not taught how to have relationships, and we're certainly not taught how to have good sexual relationships. And that sexual communication, rather than consent, is where I feel the conversation needs to be heading and normalised. And it's beyond consent. Then it's about just making it work. There are lots of things that happen during sex that are not about sexual harm that we need to be communicating about. One of the things I want to be clear is that I'm not meaning by that negotiation that people have the right to really push their agenda and to think, oh, I can negotiate what I want here. No, you know, you might have in mind what you'd like to happen, and it's very important that that's just an idea in amongst a smorgasbord of possibilities, and you can put that forward. Or make some overtures carefully, checking as you go, is this okay? And the signals that you're getting, the feedback you're getting, is where you really need to draw the line. It can't be something that you think, I'll negotiate, I'll barter, I'll keep trying. It's not that you always meet your needs at all during sex.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess at what point in that negotiation would it be wise to say leave it and move on from maybe engaging in that right now or engaging in that particular act?
If you are still unclear, If you're wanting to do something and you're still unclear that that person's consenting and you're unclear about what they're wanting to do, that is enough for you to say we can't do that then. And we don't have to always know the whys, because people have lots of life experiences. We go through all sorts of things as human beings. We don't always understand someone's background, their childhood, all sorts of things that can, you know, what's happened today at work. We just need to know and respect that lots of things impact on our sexual desire and our sexual functioning and our willingness to do things at times. So we don't need to make a big deal of it, take it personally. We certainly need to learn just to kind of move on, just accept that, either stop, check in, should we stop, should we do something else, let's go and watch TV. That's the grounds, that uncertainty. And if you're unsure, you can ask, but if you're still unsure, take that as a no.
And you have spoken to some of the legislation that is surrounding consent. So if someone finds themselves in a position where someone didn't respect their no, or they've sort of ended up in a situation that has violated their consent, what are their legal rights after that happens?
Yeah. When we're talking about their rights have been violated, various things can apply. In certain contexts, definitely during your education, your studies, definitely when you're engaged in purchasing goods and services. So, for example, public transport is included in that, or in the workplace. As just some examples, sexual harassment may apply, which is more of a civil kind of case that we're talking about there. You can complain to your education body, your accommodation provider, public transport authorities, etc., if somebody in those environments has been engaging in harassing behaviour. That may or may not include criminal behaviour, so some forms of assault, for example. So that's one area that people have the right to complain, and it will be taken up as a misconduct case, or they can sue a person under a civil act for money if that behaviour has taken place. Yeah, that's quite a complicated and overlapping area. What I want to say, though, is that then we've got criminal behaviour. So that may or may not include criminal behaviour, or separately you can go just to SAPOL, South Australian Police, and make a complaint around criminal behaviour there. So you can do both if behaviour involves both. And, yeah, there's lots of different options actually within that. I think the best thing is to get your advice, to start with, say we've got the integrity unit here on campus that can provide advice, particularly if it involves someone from the university community. We've also got the Safer Campus community website that will tell people about what different behaviours might be called, where to go for help, either for support or to report it internally and externally. So there's lots of different options. It can get confusing. Talking to a counsellor might be the first step, because it's confidential and you can just find out and get some support at the same time. But yet, you don't have to tell one person if you tell the other. If you go to the statewide sexual assault service, Yarra Place, you don't then need to have to involve the police. If you went to the police, you don't have to then tell your counsellor or tell the university. None of these things mean that you have to take any other steps. It's very much about your rights, your choice, taking things one step at a time, hitting the pause button when you need to, because it's very difficult to do these things, taking someone with you if you can, or sitting with someone if you're making a report, maybe online to the university, can be anonymous. So, yeah, the more I talk, I could keep talking, there's lots of different options, but taking it one step at a time, giving yourself a chance to recover and stabilise. And one final thing I think I'd like to add there that we know from lots of conversations with our students is that particular our international students may sometimes have the mistaken belief that they're going to get sent home if they do speak up about something, particularly sexual harm, either to the police or the university. Absolutely important we get the message out that that is not going to happen. There is no way they're going to get sent home for complaining or for reporting in Australia. And this behaviour, we do want it to stop, and it's not okay, and we will take action. So your rights will be supported. You also have rights, once you've made a complaint, not to be bothered by that person. That's a secondary set of laws that we have there, and people need to know that too. They're protected once they do speak up.
Well, thank you so much, Jo, for sharing all this with us.
That's all right. Thank you for having me.
If anything in this conversation has raised anything for you, then please contact Lifeline at 13 11 14 or 1-800-RESPECT at 1-800-737-732. Check out the show notes of this episode for more resources if you're struggling or need support in your relationships. Of course, if you're a University of Adelaide student, then please reach out to our counselling team via the University of Adelaide's website. That's all we have time for. Thank you so much for listening in to today's episode of Take Note. If you enjoyed the show, then please follow us on Spotify and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts so that other students can find us too. You can also head over to Instagram where you can follow us at uoa.oncampus and send us a DM there with any thoughts you might have on the show. We'd love to hear from you. This episode was produced by myself, and I will see you next fortnight for another episode of Take Note.
Take note.
Take note.
Take note.
Take note.
Take note.
Take note.